Our guests are Angie Johnson from the Oregon Department of Forestry. Angie, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Lou Gugliotta, who has come out of retirement to do some PIO work for ODF as well. Lou, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Chief Lance Berry joins us as well. He's with Cal Fire. Chief, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Are you attached to the Eiler Fire specifically? I'm trying to figure out where you are these days.
Yes, I am on the assigned to the Eiler Fire.
And which is one of the ones burning in the Burney area, which is one of the major concerns for structures, certainly, at this point. Can you give us an update on what's going on down there?
Absolutely. Currently, the fire is 20% contained. It's about 28,600 acres. We're expecting to contain it on the 20th of August, so it's just a few more days here. Making great progress over the last 24 hours. The weather has moderated here, and we did get some rainfall, although in all locations, recordable locations, it was less than 1/10 of an inch, so we're talking 1/100 of an inch. But it's enough to raise the humidities, and basically the winds have been relatively calm, and they've made some great progress.
All right. And is the Eiler Fire the major source of concern for Cal Fire in the northern part of the state at this point?
Yeah, it hasn't. Yesterday, it was the number one priority in the Northern California area. Those priorities change daily. I'm not sure where it is today. But certainly, it definitely causes a lot of consternation.
And then you had some other fires going on in northeastern California. I noticed the Little Deer Fire, I guess, was one of the concerns because it had actually closed Highway 97 between Weed and Klamath Falls. Do you have information about that? I'm not sure if that's in your domain there, Chief.
Not so much. The InfoWeb site, on the website there, they have lots of information. But that fire is approximately 5,000 acres on the Klamath National Forest. And let's see here.
So you're doing the same thing we do, looking at the InfoWeb. Yeah. InfoWeb has gotten to be a great site for discovering the latest information about fires around the country, really.
Absolutely. You just Google InfoWeb, and you'll pretty much find any fire you want.
All right, let's turn to the folks here in the studio. Angie Johnson with the Oregon Department of Forestry. You're attached to the, it's still called the Beaver Complex, is it?
That's correct. I'm part of the Oregon Department of Forestry Incident Management Team, and our number is Team 2. And our incident commander is Chris Klein.
And so I noticed that there's been a fair amount of movement the last couple of days. Not of the fire, actually. The fire movement seems to have slowed considerably. It looks like you just gained maybe less than 200 acres yesterday, which is great news. What has been going on physically, though, with the whole firefighting management operation?
Well, we're transitioning. Originally, we started at Tuvalu State Park because of the Salt Creek Fire, and then the Oregon Gulch Fire took off, and so we rolled that into part of the complex since we were already in place as an incident management team. And we had both fires. So once Salt Creek started winding down, we still have crews out there, but they're in mop-up stage right now, and they should be wrapped up with that fire in a couple of days. We've moved camp up to Howl Prairie, so the transition and the movement is all in the people getting to our new camp location.
We noticed that there was a point yesterday afternoon we were trying to get a hold of somebody on the phone and just weren't getting through. And I guess that's the time you actually were physically moving. That must have been quite a convoy.
It was. And every unit or functional area, you know, logistics, operations, finance, information, you know, planning, we all were moving at different rates of speed there depending on the type of equipment and things like that we needed to move up there.
So what is the status at this point of the Oregon Gulch Fire? Lou handed me a map here, and it looks like this is from this morning. It's gotten to the Klamath River. There was some concern, I guess, about it being windy enough to actually have the fire spot across the river. What's been the situation with that?
Well, the last few days, just with the winds and they were pretty erratic out there in that area. I guess it's fairly steep canyon, so the terrain influences the wind, and then it creates a lot of squirrely fire behavior out there. So that piece of the fire right above the Oregon-California border on the east side there, that's been our pinch point there. And so we've really had a hard time getting down in there because it is canyon-like. And so the fuels, we were told today, the fuels are pretty light. So we think we can get around that today. We shouldn't see much more growth. So we're looking pretty good. We're at 30% containment right now, still reporting over 36,000 acres.
The wind was blowing rather briskly on the Rogue Valley floor last night. In fact, you know, I was watching flags blowing pretty much straight out. I don't know if that was the same kind of wind you had up there. I'm going to assume it wasn't if you were able to hold the acreage so well overnight.
Right. That's where we've been able to make the best progress is at night when things, the winds have died down and the humidity's come up and temperatures are lower. So we've gotten a lot of good work done at night during our night shift.
Okay, there's a whole lot we have yet to learn about what's going on with these fires individually and what goes on in firefights generally with our guests from ODF, Angie Johnson and Lou Gugliotta, and Chief Lance Berry from CAL FIRE. We'll come back and talk more with them about these individual fire situations and more broadly about firefighting generally, and take your phone calls and emails. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about wildland fires and this season with you and our guests in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about wildland fires, which are a large topic in our region of late, with hundreds of thousands of acres on fire on both sides of the state line, and homes still threatened on both sides of the state line as well, from primarily the Oregon Gulch fire on the Oregon side and the Eiler fire, causing a lot of consternation on the California side. I should point out Oregon Gulch is also in California, so it involves both CAL FIRE and the Oregon Department of Forestry. From CAL FIRE, we have Chief Lance Berry on the phone. We have in the studio Angie Johnson from the Oregon Department of Forestry and Lou Gugliotta, who I can update his title now. He's not with ODF at the moment. He's part of the state fire marshal's team. We'll explain red team, blue team, green team in just a few moments. But you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You may have many questions about the whole process that goes on in any individual fire and what goes on generally for any fire. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Chief Berry, I want to come back to you just to talk about specific challenges on the specific fires you're working with right now, because each fire has its own terrain, its own fuels, its own weather situations. What have been some of the biggest challenges you've faced on those fires in the Burney area?
I think the largest challenge has been the drought has certainly caused some challenges. The fuel is at historically low fuel moistures. If you look at a timber 2x4 that you buy at the store, the humidities in the fuel, the forest fuels, are much, much lower than that, and that's kiln-dried lumber. So basically we have, in some way, kiln-dried lumber out in the forest, and that's been a big challenge because the dry fuels make the fuels very receptive to spot fires, you know, embers that are cast out in front of the main fire, and that just complicates your problem when you have a new start every quarter mile, you know, constantly. And that's probably the biggest challenge with, you know, forestry firefighting in general.
Some of the pictures that were coming in from the Burney area, even over the weekend, just these huge plumes of smoke from the fires. It looked like they were right in the backyard of Burney, but how close is it to town, actually?
I believe it got as close as about 3 to 4 miles from the outskirts of Burney, so certainly way close as far as our comfort level and the residents' comfort level. And smoke causes its own problems, you know, with visibility and the winds from the fire basically causing problems with the aircraft. You know, they can't be as effective if they can't get into where they need to make those water drops or retardant drops. So those are all challenges as well.
You talked about the embers and spotting. I mean, how far can embers travel from the original fire and stay alive?
It all depends on how much heat is being generated and what kind of ember was lofted up in the column. But certainly a quarter mile to a half mile is relatively common on the large timber fires. And I'm sure historically there's been longer distances. But if you got something that's happening a quarter mile behind you, it's pretty hard to pick it up when it's just happening constantly. So that's one of our biggest challenges. It's a safety issue, and it certainly is a control issue.
I got Angie Johnson just to talk about some of the challenges on the Oregon Gulch Fire. You mentioned already that some squirrely winds up there, canyons, things that will make the winds move a little differently. Those were clearly the major challenges there. The plume that people saw from the valley floor on Thursday night was nothing short of amazing. I guess it formed what people call the pyrocumulus cloud. What's going on there?
Well, it's just the fire is just generating so much there that it's created its own plume, and with that comes its own weather. And so you can even get lightning coming out of there. And then, you know, like was already mentioned, you know, stuff gets pushed and thrown in front of it. And so, and then the biggest worry is when it decides to collapse, and then you get the big downdraft, and then that really can scatter a bunch of embers and things like
that. So everything that goes up comes down again with some force?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And when does that usually happen? Is it in, I mean, assuming most of the fire crazy activity tends to be in the hot part of the day, like from about 5 to 7 p.m., I mean, does it all come crashing down on you right after dark?
Well, it depends. I mean, it could get carried off, but yeah, you do always have to worry about the downdraft.
That's some crazy stuff to think about. I mean, a fire. I mean, I've been aware of the fact that fire is creating their own lightning, but or their own weather. But actually, lightning caused fire creating more lightning. Just seems like double punishment or something.
It can be, and with our team comes, we do have a weather person who's an expert in the weather, and then also a fire behavior person that's an expert in the fire behavior, and that's their job is to constantly keep an eye on those kind of conditions so that they can get the words out to the crews when they see anything like that with potential.
Now, Lou Gugliotta, I saw a quote from you in the Mail Tribune over the weekend, I guess, where you were one of the people quoted as saying, look, it's making its own weather of the Oregon Gulch Fire. Would you explain a little more about what you are doing specifically? Because you seem to have worn two hats so far already with the Oregon Gulch Fire.
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. Being part of the Oregon State Fire Marshal's incident management teams, they developed three teams, which was blue, green, and red, and there's different positions, and basically we're an on-the-move fire department overhead team or management team. And with that, you have a problem in your area like this fire, and the local resources have done everything they physically can, and they're tired, and they also need to still maintain their emergency delivery system for the area for everybody else besides the fire. So they ask for help. And there's a system in place for doing that. And when the fire gets to a reasonable part where it might go out and destroy other things or continue to grow and get into other people's areas and districts, and with the possibility of losing structures and life safety, the request for what is known as a conflagration goes up to the state fire marshal. And from there, it goes to the governor, and they review it. Does it have warrant to do that? And in this case, it did. So when that happens, one of the teams who happens to be on call, we alternate weeks, gets a call and says, we need you to move your team to that area and manage the fire. And with that, we basically set up a little fire department and fire camp. And then we have plans chiefs and logistics chiefs and so on and so forth. They develop a plan for what's going to take place and what the needs are. And then we request all those resources from around the state. And what you wind up with is what we have today at Howard Prairie. At the fire camp, there's 1,573 people there and all kinds of equipment. And you have your helicopters flying. You have your air tankers that were needed. And you make a plan. And we have two shifts. Both of them start. They're 12-hour shifts. I think right now we're running 7 to 7 and 7 to 7. And they have a plan each day. And with that, they have a supervisor and they have basically like a battalion chief within a fire department. Our major concern from the state fire marshal's office is, once again, life safety and structural damage. And when that risk is over, we would demobilize ourselves and we would move on.
So the figure I keep hearing from Oregon Gulch is 270 structures threatened or 270 homes threatened. Is that square?
Yeah, I would say that was a general area. I believe at one time we recorded there were 43 directly in the zone, may have been 47. At one time, and many outbuildings have been destroyed, and a few residential structures have been destroyed.
Was it eight residences? Is that what I heard?
Six.
Residences? Six. Six residences destroyed by the Oregon Gulch Fire.
Yeah, okay. Three were right off the bat. This is one of those fires, I think, as Chief was saying, this is one of those fires. We get them in southern Oregon, And some people are confused. We have fires here when it's dry that grow really quick. And some don't. It's a phenomenon. But this one absolutely just started out, and it started to grow. And when that area that's up there, even though they have a fabulous fire department, there's not enough resources up there to have a fire that starts at 10 acres, goes to 100, goes to 300. You turn around and somebody said, we're at 1,000 acres, and you go, you got to be kidding. And there's just, you all of a sudden got to get all these resources to come in and try to handle that.
And then 10,000 acres on Friday and 10,000 acres on Saturday. So, right. Yeah, it was a pretty impressive growth of fires. We're talking about not just specifically the fires going on currently in our region, but also firefighting generally with Lou Gugliotta from part of the State Fire Marshal's team. Angie Johnson is with Oregon Department of Forestry, and we have Chief Lance Berry on the phone with us from Cal Fire. You can join us on the exchange. Here's your chance to ask some questions about firefighting practices and what's going on with these fires specifically. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So just to come back around to the beginning of what you were saying, Lou, when Governor Kitzhaber declared the Conflagration Act, you are the embodiment of what happens when it's declared.
That's correct.
You show up.
That's right. And we show up. Once again, we're just like a portable fire department. We have a chief, which we call our incident commander, and it moves all on down. And Angie and I are in the information part of it, which is really getting all the intel we can and trying to get it out to the public. And I believe that sometimes can be frustrating. It's frustrating for us, too, because when the major fire is going at that height of confusion, it's hard to get stuff to us so we can get it out in a timely manner right up front. And there's always an energy level right up front. You know, oh, my gosh, what's happening? Where is it? What's going on? And we try to reorganize each day and get more out and more out and more out.
Which can be tricky, I'm sure, because for one thing, I noticed that from reports of fires on both sides of the state line, aircraft are doing the initial reconnaissance to figure out what got burned or what. And you can't tell from the air. Was that a home? Was that a barn? Was that, you know, when it's just the edges of the building surviving.
Right.
Chief Lance Berry at Cal Fire, we're talking about the number of homes potentially in the way here. What are the standing evacuation orders in the general zone of the fires in the Burney area?
Currently, the communities of Hat Creek, Castle, an area known as Big Eddy Estates, and Johnson Park, which is just east of Burney, are under mandatory evacuation. The residents of Burney proper have been given an evacuation advisory, basically, you know, prepare yourself, get your stuff together, have a plan. And that's where we're at now. The highways going through those locations have been closed.
So that's Highway 89, for State Highway 89, for example?
Yes, Highway 89 between Black Ranch Road and Burney and Highway 299 between Black Branch Road and Burney, and Highway 89, what we call Four Corners there. So that's been closed. Highway 89, pretty much the length of it from 299 down to Highway 44 has been closed. And the Castle Fall River Road, Dinock Road, those routes have been closed off. There is a detour that goes around all that, and so folks can get in. They can travel from Burney to Fall River, you know, kind of bypass that Johnson Park area. But things are looking better today, and we're trying very hard to open up some of those areas and hopefully provide some kind of repopulation effort here as soon as possible. Because, you know, we know people don't like to be out of their homes, and we just got to make sure that it's safe for them. We have to do some what we call snagging, you know, remove hazardous trees that are in danger of falling on people. The power company, Pacific Gas and Electric, they have a lot of work to do replacing, burned infrastructure in there. And then, of course, we got to go in and just make sure that there's nothing that'll cause injuries to people, and we can let them in.
Angie Johnson at the Oregon Gulch Fire, I noticed that some of the evacuation orders had been downgraded just a bit by yesterday afternoon. Are those still where they were at that time?
Yeah, those areas that we had at level 3, they are currently level 2. Jackson County Sheriff's Office issued a joint news release on that yesterday. The Sheriff's Office is the one that actually administers that. We recommend they put the order out and then they administer that. What's the level 2 downgrade is still they need to be they call it ready, set, go. And so they need to be set. They need to be prepared to move at a moment's notice if we come back in and say, you got to go. The areas that are under a level two, they're closed to public. So the residents can get in there, but there's no public traffic on those roads.
And at this point, that's still Copco Road from the 6,000 block on up.
Yep.
Right to the California state line. Now, we're still at level one along parts of Highway 66, generally west of Copco Road?
East,
okay. East of Copco Road.
Yeah. And we've had some confusion with that, you know, just to make, we've had folks call from Ashland thinking they're at a level one, but it's not Ashland proper, it's just that stretch of 66, everybody that lives along there.
I do notice that folks in my business can make things a little more confusing because you get the reporters from out of the area who say a fire near Ashland and people in Ashland think, is it near me? Well, it's not. I mean, it's a good 20 miles from Ashland, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
Maybe more than that.
It's probably at the 16-mile marker on Highway 66 all the way down. You actually turn on the Copco Road about the 25 or 6-mile marker.
Right,
so on Highway 66.
Right, so it is a long way from a major population center. We're talking about fires specifically and firefighting more generally with Lou Gugliotta from the State Fire Marshal's team, Angie Johnson from Oregon Department of Forestry, and Chief Lance Berry from Cal Fire here on the Jefferson Exchange. Chief, to come back to you, you were talking about removing snags and things like that could fall on people and things that have to go on in the zone as the firefight goes on. So just for the folks who just don't get to see a lot of what goes on out there, how close do firefighters actually get to roaring flames and things like that? I imagine you try to keep it as unexciting as possible. Chief Berry, you still there? Chief Lance Berry? Okay, he's gone.
Here I am. No,
okay.
I'm still here.
Okay, here we go.
I didn't understand your question. Could you repeat it?
The question was, you were talking about people going in to remove snags and things that could fall on people, just the process of taking down some of the damaged trees and things. But how close do firefighters ever actually get to flames? I mean, you're trying to play a fairly defensive game here to not put people in danger, right?
Oh, absolutely. Really, the safest way to fight a fire is what we call one foot in the black, one foot in the burn, which means basically you're right on the fire's edge. We call that direct. And if the fire conditions allow it, that's what we do. We go direct as much as possible. There's many advantages to that. One is the fire perimeter is the smallest when you're all done. The other is you're very close to the burned area. You can step into the burned area or something like that for safety reasons. You don't have a lot of fuel between, if you're going indirect, some of the disadvantages are there's a lot of fuel between you and the fire, so the fire can get a big run at you and, you know, so generally, for all practical purposes, most fires we fight even are direct. It's when sometimes, you know, I have a phrase is that sometimes the monster is going to eat and you just got to get out of the way. And so in those situations, we basically try to get to the heel of the fire, anchor it, and then work up the sides or work up the flanks and just try to stay with it. And then as soon as the weather conditions change, the fuel conditions change, the terrain changes, some type of change happens, then we can come across the head of the fire and pinch it off. That's pretty much wildland firefighting 101.
All right. Lou Gugliotta, I see you nodding. It takes a fair amount of skill, though, to be able to read a fire and figure out which direction it's going, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, that is the skill level. This particular fire, Chief, you know, it went through so fast that there was a lot of unburned material in the middle and around it. You actually drove through some black. You all of a sudden you say, well, the fire was never here for about 150 yards, and all of a sudden you're in black again. And then when it came through and we had a huge acreage growth on that one day, the winds had reversed it back, and it came back and took out that material that hadn't been burned yet.
Really? So this is like a two-pass fire.
Right. So to answer your question, you need the skill level in the field to realize that's happening, to make sure that you're protecting everybody, and life safety always comes first.
So when we used to talk about the lined, contained, control, do we still talk about those steps, Angie Johnson?
Right, exactly. We cannot call a fire controlled until we're absolutely certain it's dead out.
In fact, I don't even notice the use of the term anymore. It seems like it goes lined, contained, and mop up.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And control, a lot of times in some of these areas, control doesn't come until after the snow flies.
when things are actually getting all damp again. We'll come back and talk more about firefighting. We have a couple of phone calls waiting. We're talking to Angie Johnson at Oregon Forestry, Lou Gugliotta, who's part of the state fire marshals team, and Chief Lance Berry from Cal Fire talking to us as well. Back with our guests and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about wildland firefighting in the context of the current fires still burning in our region. We have folks here from the Oregon Gulch Fire, and we have Chief Lance Berry from Cal Fire down at the Eiler Fire in the Burney area. Lou Gugliotta from the State Fire Marshal's team is part of the crew here in the studio with Angie Johnson from the Oregon Department of Forestry. General questions about firefighting generally or more specific questions about these fires are welcome at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. And Lou, you were just starting on a little riff before we got back on the air about containment. And you know, people just get to the, all right, it's 100% contained, everything's right. Good. Well, not necessarily.
Right. I think containment, you were saying a minute ago, we don't necessarily use containment anymore. And that's because I think it gives you a false sense of what's going on there. I think some people read containment like, okay, we're all good, we can go to lunch now. Well, I like to refer it to a small campfire when you're camping. And you might have a 3-foot rock pit, and the family's been doing well, and you've had a nice fire in there, and someone says, we're leaving right now, go get some water. And I think you're always shocked how much water it takes to put out that little 3-foot fire that you've developed. Well, in this case, we've got fire that's miles long. We've contained it. That's our rocks around it, but we still have to put out the fire. And it takes a lot of work to do that.
All right, yeah, so we don't say controlled anymore. But basically, you can get a line around a fire. You can actually have fire line constructed, but you don't call it contained until what happens, Angie Johnson?
Well, until that line is secure, you want to make sure that it can withstand any wind that might come up, that kind of thing, that it won't jump that line that you've built again.
So, Chief Berry, when you're out there making a fire line, how wide does it have to be, or is that totally a function of the circumstances in that particular fire?
It is totally circumstances of the fire. It could be, you know, in grass fuels, light grass, it could just be a foot wide. And in a timber component, like pretty much what we're talking about here, it could be 100 feet wide. You know, 10 dozer blades wide is sometimes what we have to do. And this particular fire, we did put in line that was at times 10 dozer blades wide to protect the town of Burney. So that's, it all depends on how tall the fuel is. It also, another consideration is the fuel itself, the ground itself. In some areas, because it's a wilderness area or whatnot, you have to be a little more cognizant of the wilderness restrictions, which may mean, you know, 4-foot wide line, that's as wide as you can get, even though normally you'd like to go better, but because of the place that it's in and the environmental damage, we can't do that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask about if you have to act differently in different areas. I mean, obviously, in some places you're going to have terrain steep enough to not be able to use a dozer, but in wilderness areas, for example, would you not use a dozer at all because of the machinery restrictions?
Correct. There's areas on this fire that mechanized equipment is not allowed, and it's a challenge, but we work through it. Generally, the threat to the public or the infrastructure in most wilderness areas is moderated, so it's, you know, we just work through it and keep after it.
All right, let's take some calls for our guests here. We're talking about wildland fires. Here's Fred in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, hello. I have two questions, really. I had read a while back that the number of air tankers in the western United States years ago was something like 80-something, and it had been reduced to around 3 operating tankers recently while they were waiting for some new ones, new jets or planes to come online. So my question was, how many tankers are available, and would more help? And second question is, what kind of preventive measures are planned for the future in terms of clearing brush or even setting preventive fires. So two questions, please.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate it, Fred. Angie, you want to take on the part about tankers, or Lou?
I just know for ourselves, for Oregon Department of Forestry, because of just what the caller referenced, there being trouble with getting tankers on contract through the federal system, the state, Oregon Department of Forestry, decided to go ahead and contract two of their own tankers. So for ODF, we resolved that by going ahead and putting on a couple of tankers contracted solely for our use.
Just in terms of procedure, too, when you lay down retardant drops from planes, are you trying to basically lay something across the road? Are you trying to lay it alongside to sort of divert it into a smaller channel? Or what's the usual procedure there?
Well, you're trying to lay it along the hot piece of the line. And the thing with retardant is if you're going to use it, you need to back it up with something. So it's not the retardant. You can't just use retardant. You lay the retardant down. And then you can get in there, it kind of delays, and you can get in there with crews or a dozer or whatever.
Chief Barry at Cal Fire. Cal Fire has a fair number of its own aircraft. I mean, we are talking a big state with lots of fires. So what's the aircraft situation for you?
Yeah, Cal Fire has usually 23 S2 tankers. These are turbine engines, and they have 11 helicopters in the fleet and 14 air attack ships. And that's basically it on the application of retardant. That's, you know, just like the name says, it's a solution that retards the spread of the fire. And so a lot of times people get frustrated because they see the fire just cranking off and there's no aircraft putting retardant down out there. And a lot of times that's a decision that's based on the fact that there's no ground resources to follow it up. So we need to put the retardant where it'll do the most good, which is oftentimes on the flanks. And again, with the way these timber fires have been burning lately, it's very hard to put aircraft at the head of the fire. If the smoke column is laying down, they can't get underneath what we call getting underneath the smoke. If the smoke is right on the ground, you can't fly. They have to fly with visual flight rules, you know, so they have to see where they're flying, so we can't just send them blindly into the smoke. So we have a lot of safety considerations to consider. But that's basically it as far as the aircraft goes. We're very lucky in California to have such a large fleet. And we use those aircraft cooperatively. We do use them across the border in Oregon on occasion, and certainly with the Forest Service to assist them on their fires here in the Forest Service Region 5.
So the other part of Fred's question was about prevention, specifically about the setting preventive fires, which is that seems like a... With all the different land ownership, that could be a tricky question. But, I mean, is this something that gets discussed within places like ODF and the State Fire Marshal's Office?
Yeah, I think Oregon's been a leader in that, actually. We started with our wildland-urban interface, not only the policies, but also the direction and the public information that instructs people exactly what would make them safer than non-safe.
Defensible space.
Defensible
all the FireWise
space. And now FireWise. And FireWise was originated through... NFPA, and it's come to Oregon. We're doing a great job there and willing to help anybody that wants information, willing to go out to their home and show them what they could do individually, even on their property. And it does help. I mean, it's amazing what happens when you have a 100-foot clearance and when you don't have a 100-foot clearance. One could represent safety, and one could represent you need to evacuate.
Let's take a call from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking wildfires.
Thanks. Good program, and I sure appreciate the firefighters. That's got to be the hottest, hardest work going on out there in the Poison Oak and everything. But I have just a practical question. I have a friend that's driving this way from Lakeview, and I said there must be some, you know, smoke advisory service to help determine whether to drive north or south and things like that. Is there such a thing, and how do we contact it?
All right, that's a question. Let's see if we can get it from our firefighters. In the meantime, I'll look up the DEQ AQI, Air Quality Index, which is a pretty good indicator.
There's another site. It's called Oregon Smoke. It's a blog. And the regional office for Pacific Northwest Region, USDA Forest Service, they're the ones that manage that site. And they have an air quality manager that takes care of that. Also, when you're traveling, ODOT will post something if they've closed a highway or something because of visibility due to smoke from a fire.
We have also used, Brad, airnow.gov, which will give an indication in all parts of the country, depending on where you want to look. At the moment, since you asked, I'm showing green, so good air conditions in the Rogue Valley, moderate in Klamath Falls and at Crater Lake, and looks like it's moderate at Lakeview as well. But so that's the worst of the air quality in the region so far. Chief Barry down in California, has the air quality been an issue for you guys?
It has been. Around here, usually it's the local counties and health departments that issue health advisories, you know, depending on the severity of the smoke. I'm not really sure if there's I'm not familiar with any websites that kind of go globally across the state. I'm sure they're there. But that's how it happens here is a lot of times you'll see in the newspapers and on the media that the local health department is advising, you know, people with asthma or elderly stay indoors or whatnot because of the smoke conditions.
Okay, there is a Siskiyou County Pollution Control District for the folks in Siskiyou County. That's tinyurl.com, LJZAK8A. We'll make sure we put this up on our Facebook page to make sure that people can get a hold of that. One of the things I have noticed from going to airnow.gov myself on smoky days is that if there are not regular monitors in the area, it's just hard to get a feeling for what, I mean, so an area like Burney would not necessarily have regular air quality monitors going on if it has not been, for example, a non-attainment area in the past, as Medford has been, for example. So let's take another call. Here's Derek and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking fires with Angie Johnson, Lou Gugliotta, and Lance Berry.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment that will maybe help segue into more policy discussion. Fred made a point about fire, I guess, it was interpreted as maybe burnouts or whatever. But how about prescribed fire? I mean, we look at the last 100 years of fairly successful suppression. The result is we've got fuel that has not burned, despite our efforts through logging to remove the large, less flammable material. The bole of the tree, we leave a lot of slash in the woods, and especially with these weather and wind-driven events, that fuel will burn whether we want it to or not at times, despite our best efforts in suppression. So I think it's important to remember that there's going to have to be reintroduction of fire into the ecosystem. We've talked about it for decades, but the practical reality is nobody wants to touch it because it's risky and nobody likes to see the woods burning up and the tails of the seasons. And so I guess I'd just like you guys to address that because it seems imperative that we're going to have to get fire back in there to burn the fuel because we can't simply leave it out there.
All right. Thanks for that, Derek. Appreciate it. Chief Barry, I want to come to you with that one because we've talked about the Oregon side just a bit in that respect. But how much discussion is there within Cal Fire, for example, and with the National Forests in California about, and the many national parks as well, about prescribed fire and putting fire back into the ecosystem?
Yeah, I can speak with the Cal Fire perspective is, you know, our mission is to protect the private lands. And that is a challenge when it comes to prescribed burning because if we try to do any type of prescription burn, you know, scale is better. So you don't want to just do like a 5 acre here, a 5 acre there, or even 100 acres here, 100 acres there. You try to get as many of the large landowners together as possible and, you know, work with the cooperators and try to, you know, package up large prescription burns. And that is the biggest challenge as far as getting everybody to agree. Some people, they don't want their land burned. This is their land, and they wouldn't like it burned. And other issues are the smoke impacts. I mean, there's just a plethora of things to work through. And I certainly agree that the, you know, prescription, there is a place for prescription type burning, and that's the challenge, is making it all go together. As far as the forest, they do have, you know, some control burn plans and operations that they do every year, especially in the Shasta County area. And many of, you know, those are very successful and certainly helps the forest. And then the other thing I've noticed lately is we're seeing a lot of use of the wood products. So even if they go in and they log, they take the brush and the scrap, whatever, and they chip it up, and there's a market for wood chips. And so that stuff is, that biomass is being harvested. So that is helping with the like cogeneration plants and stuff like that. So we are taking advantage, I think, in many areas of some of that fuel that historically would just lay there and either rot or burn eventually.
We have a question here from Scott in Ashland, and this is related directly to you, Angie Johnson, about what is burning in the Oregon Gulch Fire. Is it destroying major stands of timber, he writes, or mainly affecting brush and grass? Will this be an event that the ecosystem will recover from relatively quickly and that may even have some benefits, or one that will leave the area devastated for years? That from Scott in Ashland.
Actually, it's all of the fuel you mentioned, the grass, the shrub, the timber component.
It's a real variety. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it, you know, it depends. Obviously, I think Lou alluded to that some of it is fairly mosaic. So there's areas that didn't burn. There's areas that burned completely. And then there's areas that may have been a nice prescribed fire. With private land, you know, once that's the thing with private land, they can do what they need to do to help get their land back to where it was. And so sometimes it's a little bit more difficult because it's costly.
All right. Lots of questions and lots of stuff to talk about. Wish we had you another hour, but we'll have to stop it there with Angie Johnson from Oregon Department of Forestry, Lou Gugliotta, part of the State Fire Marshals team in Oregon, and Chief Lance Berry from Cal Fire. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a study on outcomes for English learners in Oregon schools. Our Vents Day segment, you pick the topic. We'll talk about Zionism in relation to Gaza, and we'll talk about California's gun bill involving mental health. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of the book, The Invisibles, about those anonymous workers who are best left anonymous. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our producer, Charlotte Duren. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.